We were talking about the way in which the effects of the Great Awakening affected society. And we had gotten to the point of saying that the redefinition of sin had a social impact. If individuals can stop sinning, so can societies. And if everyone stops sinning in a society, society is going to become perfected. Perhaps so perfected that it will be a sight for the return of Jesus, the second coming. And in the period before the Civil War, hundreds of thousands, then millions of Americans joined voluntary associations to reform American society. And the social energy of the Great Awakening was one of the most important sources of that reform movement. Now, and this is where I'd gotten to. That reform movement empowered two different marginalized groups of Americans. One of them was female people. Women in the early 19th century were beginning to be relegated to what came to be called the domestic sphere. Their sphere of influence is what? The home, and oh, the home has an adjunct. Good. The church. And in the home and the church, they are supposed to civilize, domesticate, civilize, even Christianize dirty men who are going to go out in New Jacksonian competitive America and compete with each other. Sometimes they have to do bad things. They have to be selfish and aggressive and greedy. Those are bad things, right? But society has in place a check, a redeeming point. Women and the church and the home are going to redeem them. Their allies, who were also empowered, were the clergy, the male clergy. By the early 19th century, religion is beginning to be more and more female in its component and its message. The ministry begins to be marginalized by its association with women. But in the churches, women and ministers found power and leverage in the room of competitive, in the world of competitive individualism. In this new world of competitive capitalism, someone has to make sure that people are virtuous and good. Women and ministers, that's your charge. The domestic sphere. The last of the three impacts of the awakening was reliance on emotion. The Great Revival had solidified the centrality of emotion and appeals to the heart in American religion. The encounter with Jesus that was at the center of the conversion experience took place in one's inner being and occurred at the effective seat of emotion. We all know that now, don't we? The Great Reform Movement was powered in part by the energy that was created by this appeal to emotion. Alrighty. Now, I'm going to illustrate all of this by talking about the most important of the Crusades, the Reform Movement, which is, of course, the Crusade against slavery. In the context of the 19th century world, the thing about American society that most needed to be changed, of course, was slavery. The existence of permanent, inherited, racial slavery. Slavery in America was permanent, it was inherited, it was based exclusively on race. And young people, by 1860, there was no other slave system like it in the world. Write it down. Its existence, slavery's existence, at least in the eyes of the world, made a mockery of the Great Declaration on which the Republic had been established. And more to the point for Dr. Miller's class, for our class, the institution of slavery seemed to mock the very essence of the gospel of Jesus Christ that was supposed to be so crucial to the identity of the American Republic. All right, quick and dirty, history of slavery in America. 3 minutes. Can you handle that? Slavery had been almost universal in colonial America. It was everywhere. No South, no North. It was everywhere. As far as I know, virtually no voices were raised in the colonial period against slavery. Folks, we had to have the revolution first. Actually, first we had to have the awakening. In the Great Revival, white Christians first began to think about doing a better job of taking care of the souls of black people. So for the first time, they did a little mission work with slaves. Not much. But around the time of the American Revolution, one American group, and folks, it's not until the 1750s and 60s, one group began to purge itself of slaveholders. One religious group. Guess which one? The Quakers. The Quakers. But folks, not even they did it. Folks, why did you not criticize slavery in 1690? Morally. Because it was accepted as the heir. People had not yet thought that thought. Slavery was a part of the way the world was. We have to have consciences quickened before we can oppose it. And it's slow in coming. In the 18th century, although it was widespread everywhere, slavery began to be crucial only to the economics and social institutions of the southern colonies. It was everywhere, but it becomes crucial to society and the economy only in the area south of Pennsylvania. And it is in that area, around Pennsylvania, Maryland, that the Quakers began in the 1760s to purge their membership. But then comes the Revolution, with its emphasis on equality. The rhetoric of the white man's revolution exposed the hypocrisy of slavery. And we begin to hear for the first time a dissonance between the words white people used and their institutions. For the first time, folks, it took the radical revolution to do that. But it does do it. And gradually, in the last 20 years of the 18th century, colonies, now states, north of the Mason-Dixon line, the boundary between Pennsylvania and Massachusetts. Don't write that down. Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and Maryland began to emancipate their slaves slowly, gradually, and paid for them, right? By 1800, something had changed. By 1800, slavery was on its way to becoming what comes to be called in the 19th century the South's, can someone tell you what I'm going to say? The South's peculiar institution, not weird, but unique too. Now, does that mean all slaves ceased to exist in the 19th century? In the 19th century in the North? No, it was gradual. Does that mean that the American Revolution ended slavery? Huh? It did, finally. What did it do then, folks? It divided the North and the South on the issue of slavery. Folks, what finally ends slavery? War, blood. What do you have a war? And to have conflict, what do you have to have? Two sides. The revolution and its rhetoric produces the two sides. By 1800, the South is beginning to be defensive. All righty? Folks, I told you this is quick and dirty. Opposition to slavery in the first 30 years of the 19th century did not call for the out-and-out abolition of slavery. And it certainly did not call for the integration of black folk into American culture. Early opposition to slavery called for emancipation to be gradual. Voluntary. No one's going to make you into slaves. And compensating. And that's how slavery was ended in the North. All righty? And After 1817, a reform group was organized to get rid of the freed slaves. And another characteristic comes up. All of this emancipation is to be followed by returning them to Africa. Let's call it colonization. In 1817, American Colonization Society was created to send free people back to Africa. Almost no white people in the 1830s could imagine blacks and whites living together in equality in the American Republic. This gradual approach to the opposition to the ending of slavery ended with a bang, actually, in 1831. In 1831, in the south side of Virginia, a black preacher man named Nat Turner, rose in rebellion and slaughtered 55 white people. Nat Turner's Rebellion. In the January before then, in Boston, a man named William Lloyd Garrison began to publish a new journal called The Liberator. In its masthead, he said, "I will be heard." And in The Liberator, William Lloyd Garrison began to preach a new gospel of emancipation, calling for the immediate abolition of slavery. It was not to be gradual. It was not to be voluntary. And it was not to be compensated. And before the onslaught of the Liberator and a growing abolition movement in the North, and in the onslaught of terror in their own minds after Nat Turner's Rebellion, the South began to turn in against itself in the 1830s and 40s. In the 1820s and 30s, sensitive, intelligent Southerners like Thomas Jefferson had admitted that slavery was evil and that in the best of all possible worlds, it would not exist. But this is not the best of all possible worlds. But it's not just an evil. What kind of an evil is it? Necessary. It's a necessary evil because we need them to work for us and because slavery keeps them in their place, in subservience. In the 1830s, the South switches its defense. They no longer admit that slavery was an evil. They begin to declare that it is a positive good. The best of all possible worlds instituted by guess whom? God. It was the best of all possible ways instituted by God to keep inferior blacks in their place and to put them under the care of a benevolent white class. All righty. I told you it's going to be quick and dirty. Hang in there. The most important element of the crusade against slavery in the North was the evangelical Christianity that came out of the Second Great Awakening. But abolitionists had difficulty in recruiting Jesus as an abolitionist. What did Jesus say in the Bible about slavery? He walked in Galilee and Judea for 3 years. Slaves were everywhere. What did he say about it? Obey your masters? Nope. It wasn't Jesus. Who was that? Paul. We'll get to him. What did our Lord say? This is the only time where silence is the right question, the right answer. He didn't say anything. Check it out. Jesus never criticized human bondage at all. how are we going to make him an abolitionist? And to make things worse, here comes Paul, who says a lot about it. And it's not good. Paul wrote a letter, the book of Philemon. It's one of those little books in the back of the Bible that you have to use your table of contents to find. There was a Christian, a white Christian named Philemon, a friend of Paul. He had a slave. His name was Onesimus. Almost certainly, Onesimus was not a person of color. He was probably, how did he get to be a slave? How could you get to be a slave in the ancient world? What? Debt? Conquered? Some people did volunteer, actually. Well, how else? Is that it? No. What's one more? You could be doing what? Committing a crime. You can be punished. Right? In my other book, Ben-Hur, Judah Ben-Hur, that would be Charlton Heston, commits a crime, apparently, and he is punished by being sold into slavery at the galleys. Was it permanent? In that case, it was. But it wasn't always. Slavery was something that you could rise out of sometime. And it wasn't always passed on to your children. And it wasn't based on race. We don't know anything about Onesimus except that he decided, after he became a Christian too, did I tell you that? He became a Christian too, probably converted by Philemon or Paul. And he decided that it was wrong for, fill in the blank, for Christians to own other Christians. So he ran away from Philemon, but here's his mistake. Guess who he ran to? Paul. And Paul was in a dilemma. Because Onesimus was a good man. But Paul also believed in the subordination of inferiors to superiors. And that wouldn't just be slaves and masters. Who else would it be, young people? Women and men, husbands and wives. So, not so much in the book of Philemon, but a little bit of the book of Philemon and several other Pauline writers, he lays out a Christian doctrine of mutual subordinations and responsibilities. And he tells Onesimus that he must go back to Philemon because it was wrong to steal Philemon's property, even if it's his own body. And he must take to him this letter, the letter to Philemon. It's one of the ones we know Paul wrote. And in it, he tells Philemon to take care of Onesimus. And he uses as an analogy. What's the analogy? You must care for Onesimus, Philemon, as, let's say God cares for us, the church, the emerging church. Folks, that's a powerful statement. And elsewhere, he says the same thing about women. A social theory of subordination and mutual obligations and responsibilities is based analogously on this most important of all relationships, God and the church. So what are the abolitionists going to do about that? Well, they kind of ignore it, which is all they can do. Folks, that's all you can do. Faced with the undeniable fact of this doctrine of Paul, the abolitionists innovated. And their innovation has important repercussions for us in our course. The abolitionists in the crusade against slavery were among the very first Americans to point out that Jesus was human in exactly the same way we are human. Just as we are, Jesus was a product of his culture. He could not be expected to rise above it. He could not be expected to think thoughts that no one else thought. You need to think about that. It's an interesting statement. Yes. Stephanie said, does that affect his divinity? No, it simply says that when Jesus is human, he is really human. That his divinity doesn't get mixed up with his humanity. Now, do you understand Stephanie's question? Nicaea, Chalcedon said that the two parts of Jesus don't get mixed up with each other. And you can't expect this man, who, when he's human, to be more than human. All righty? Folks, this is really tough. Yes? Like what? Like what? Come on. Let's do women, because people can be nice to the poor, you know, and kids. I mean, come on, kids. Oh, but you're anticipating my next point, Jordan. Thank you. Because there's a contradiction here, because Jesus does rise above his culture at one point. And folks, for Dr. Miller, one of the reasons why I think Jesus is probably divine is because at one point he did step outside humanity. And it was in his empowerment of one half the human race. He reacted to women and interacted. It's in all the scriptures. It's one of the few things that's in all of them. He interacted with women, the poor, children, other good men we interact with. Not with women. He empowered them in an extraordinary way. All righty? Now, does that have anything to do with what we're talking about slavery and the abolitionist argument? No, but it is interesting. And I wasn't about going to make the point. Okay? Okay, hang in there. Jesus is a product of his culture just like we are. So, they insist that you focus not on the specifics of Jesus' teachings, but on what? Come on. The message of the teachings. What's the message of Jesus? Can you say golden rule? I'm surprised that none of you said golden rule when I asked about what Jesus said about slavery. Because it's not explicitly about slavery, is it? But come on. Do unto others as you would do unto... You want to be a slave? I don't think so. There's a better one. Folks, can you imagine the man we encounter in the Gospels going out and buying a slave? No. And that's pretty irrefutable. So, focus on the general message. Now, most of the time, the abolitionists hoped that slaveholders would undergo a true conversion experience that would lead them to a truly godly life and cause them to free their slaves. Over and over again, they prayed that the slaveholders' hearts would melt, just as the heart of the sinner had melted at the conversion experience. This desire on the part of the abolitionist to preach a gospel to the slaveholders that would cause their hard hearts to melt is at the center of this great book, Uncle Tom's Cabin. How many of you have ever read Uncle Tom's Cabin for our class? Have you read it in high school? Did you ever read it in high school? Folks, every American should read this book. Actually, I'm very serious about that. But I'm going to read a little bit. one of the heroines, or the heroine, of this little book, this big book actually, is called Evangeline. What a name. What is the word of Evangeline? Yeah, evangelist, and she's the little evangelist. She is this Shirley Temple little Cupid doll. She's so good. She's just practically perfect. Well, near the end of this book, Harriet Beecher Stowe kills the kid off and teaches a great lesson in the doing. One time in Burdine, when I was still teaching over in that huge hall, it classes in Burdine 106, 500 people, full 500 class. Should never forget it. I was going to preach from this book. And I said, and little Eva dies. Someone from the back of the room waked up just as I said that. And this poor woman screamed, "Little Eva dies!" Sorry, guys. Yeah, little Eva dies. And it's important because women are supposed to be converting men from the hardness of capitalism and all their greed and everything. But if they can't do it in life, what do? In a pinch, they die. And if the woman can't do it, the little girl woman will do it. And the death of little Evangeline in this is the quintessence of this trope in the abolitionist gospel, that what we have to do is melt slaveholders' heart. Now, this book is written to the wives and mothers of slaveholders, not to the slaveholders themselves. They're too far gone. But if you convert the women, here we go. So, little Eva gets one of these lingering illnesses, and she is on the verge of death. And here is about a page of this. One, this is probably the most famous scene in 19th century American literature, the death of little Eva from Uncle Tom's Cabin. The people around the deathbed are Tom, the Christ figure we'll talk about in a minute, the Christ-like black slave who is perfect, not practically, he is perfect. His owner, Augustine St. Clair, a good slaveholder if there ever was one, and Mammy. The name says it, right? Everyone is told that little Eva is dying. Mammy heard the words and flew to awaken the servants. The house was soon aroused. Lights were seen, footsteps heard. Anxious faces thronged the veranda and looked tearfully through the glass doors. But Sinclair heard and said nothing, her father. He saw only that look on the face of the little sleeper. Oh, if she could only wake and speak once more, he said. And stooping over her, he spoke in her ear, "Do you know me, Eva?" "Dear Papa," said the child with a last effort, throwing her arms about his neck. In a moment they dropped again, and as Sinclair raised his head, he saw a spasm of mortal agony pass over the face. She struggled for breath and threw up her little hands. "Oh, God, this is dreadful. This is dreadful," he said, turning away in agony and wringing Tom's hand, scarce conscious of what he did. He's touching the black man. "Oh, Tom, my boy, this is killing me." Tom had his master's hands between his own, and with tears streaming down his dark cheeks, looked up for help where he had always been used to look. "Pray that this may be cut short," said St. Clair. "This wrings my heart. Oh, bless the Lord, it's over. It's over, dear master," said Tom. "Look at her." The child lay panting on her pillows as one exhausted. The large, clear eyes rolled up and fixed, and earth was past, and earthly pain. But so solemn, so mysterious was the triumphant brightness of that face that it choked even the sobs of sorrow. They pressed around her in breathless stillness. "Eva," said St. Clair gently, She did not hear. Oh, Eva, tell us what you see. What is it? Said her father. A bright, a glorious smile passed over her face, and she spoke brokenly. Oh, love, joy, peace, gave one sigh and passed from death to life. Then Stowe, as 19th century novelists did, stepped outside the narrative and addresses the reader, the trope of Victorian literature. Farewell, beloved child. The bright eternal doors have closed after thee. We shall see thy sweet face no more. Oh, woe for them who watch thy entrance into heaven when they shall wake and find only the cold gray sky of daily life, and thou gone forever. It's a sermon, and it was effective. It transformed a wild slave, and it transformed her father. Guess who it didn't transform? Her mother, whose heart was too hardened. She's the worst person in the novel. The woman who doesn't do what she's supposed to do in the domestic sphere. Alrighty? Most abolitionists did not preach violence and bloodshed. Instead, their Jesus was meek and mild. They wanted to change people by example and love. Very few of them pictured Jesus as an Old Testament prophet like Jeremiah or Amos. The abolitionist Jesus does not serve as a judge. Instead, he holds out his hands, imploring you. One of the leading female abolitionists, a woman named Angelina Grimke from South Carolina, actually, a Southerner abolitionist, compared the abolitionist as a whole. Ready for this? Compare the abolitionist to Jesus the miracle worker. Jesus had to work miracles. Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. So, Grimke said, the abolitionists are going to raise an entire race from the tomb of slavery. Garrison himself compared the abolitionists to Jesus in his relationship to the Jews. The abolitionists were a hated minority in antebellum America. Jesus was hated by the Jewish authorities. Jesus exposed the scribes and Pharisees for their corruptions and oppressions. And just like Jesus, Garrison said, the abolitionists are having to bear witness against their own nation and people in order to save the nation and its covenant with God. And like Jesus, the abolitionist Garrison said, were the innocent victims of vicious attacks from their enemies. In the title character, Uncle Tom, Harriet Beecher Stowe gave to Western literature perhaps its most compelling Christ figure. A Christ figure, of course, is a figure in literature who functions as Christ. And here is an illustration from the last chapter of Uncle Tom's Cabin called The Victory, in which Tom is martyred and Jesus comes to take him to heaven. Now, I'm actually going to give to you next time. I want to do it this time, but the copy wasn't working in the history department this morning. I'm going to actually give you a mimeograph copy next time of the chapter in which Uncle Tom dies. Because you've got to see it. All righty? And I'm going to save this for that. Most compelling Christ figure in American history. He refuses to do something that his evil master would not allow him to do. He gets so finally from St. Clair into the worst kind of slavery possible, slavery hell in Louisiana. His master is named, can someone tell me? Simon Legree, whose name has become synonymous, right, with evil. Simon Legree is the epitome of the horrible master. Where's he from? Do you know? Vermont? Not even a southerner. The worst person in the book. We're slaveholder from Vermont, right? Anyhow, a couple of the female slaves run away. Uncle Thomas knows where they are. And Simon Legree knows that he knows where they are. So he begins to beat Tom to make him tell. Actually, he doesn't beat him. He makes two slaves, Sambo and Quimbo, beat him. And they finally beat him to death. But as he dies, he converts Sambo and Quimbo with his witness. And the death of Uncle Tom transforms everybody. A selfless man who will not do something evil, even at the price of his own death. So he dies literally to save the life of these two female slaves who are actually hiding up in the attic. All righty? I'm going to give that to you to read next time. Now, but abolition had another face, didn't it? It had a violent face. We need to talk for a minute about John Brown. Very strange character, John Brown. Became obsessed with the Old Testament's concept of sin and a vengeful God. He took seriously the Old Testament prophets saying that the land must be cleansed with blood. He took seriously the scripture one can find in Matthew 10:34 when Jesus says, I come not to send peace but a sword. And in 1854, in Kansas, he leads a group of abolitionists to attack a pro-Southern camp, and blood is shed. Bleeding Kansas, 1854, as the South begins to practice for the carnage of the Civil War. Then in 1859, John Brown led a raid on a federal arsenal in Harper's Ferry, Virginia. He was captured and was hung by the federal government. Throughout his life, John Brown compared himself to Christ. And he was instantly made a martyr by the abolitionist. And a song about his death, John Brown's body lies molding in the grave, becomes one of the most popular songs of the Union Army. John Brown, in death, it seems to me, blends the Old Testament prophet and the Christian martyr into a very potent symbol of violent opposition to slavery. What happens if you really do bring the sword that Jesus said he did? We need now to turn to the South's defense of slavery and the role that Jesus played in it. By 1860, the American South was one of the last slave societies in the Western world. And it became increasingly difficult to defend its peculiar institution. The essence of that institution you can see in a movie like Gone with the Wind, a romanticized view of a peaceful South in which kindly slaveholders shoulder their responsibility for caring for ignorant, inferior slaves. They also said that the slaves of the South, who were very well taken care of, said they, were better taken care of than what they called the wage slaves of the North. By the way, the American South is not the only, are not the only people in the Western world who in the 1850s and 60s is criticizing capitalism and what it does to wage slaves. Can you think of someone else who might be saying exactly the same thing? Developing a critique in the British Library, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. There's a remarkable similarity between the South's attack on Northern capitalism and Marx's attack on all capitalism. The South simply insisted that blacks were by nature inferior to whites and had to be cared for. They said that slavery was God's plan for doing that. And they said that in the fullness of time, whites and slaves, in some way, would probably take Christianity back to Africa. God had allowed Christianity, the Christian West, to conquer Africa and to enslave its people, bring them to the land of freedom, where they become Christians, and finally, in the fullness of time, maybe, they can go back and Christianize the black continent. What role does Jesus play in the South's biblical defense of slavery? Before we do that, let me give you a little more statements about this biblical defense. The biblical defense of slavery. Slavery, they said, had been universal in the ancient world. It was everywhere. It was part of nature. They also said, maybe it's the curse of Ham. Who was Ham? One of Noah's son. What did he do that's a no-no? He saw his father's nakedness and he's cursed. Maybe he is cursed with color and having to be a slave then. The South also focused on Paul and the paternalistic theory of subordination to authority that he had developed in the letter to Philemon. In fairness to Paul, however, in another part of his writings, Paul also said that in Christ there is no free, no slave. No east, no west, no male, no female, no slave, no free. All righty. Now, what about Jesus in all this? You can't really ignore Jesus in the 19th century. But in some sense, they had Jesus on their side. As we have already said, he didn't say a word about slavery. And folks, the South kept saying that over and over again. Tell me where Jesus said slavery was wrong. They can't do it. He also told his listeners that they should render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. A verse that could be used by apologists of slavery to show that Jesus had taught acceptance of the world as they found it. They also had reference to the very ancient idea that governments are ordained by God. And slavery is protected at the very highest level in American society by the federal Constitution. Were they right? Absolutely, they were right. What finally really ends slavery? Amendments to the Constitution. But getting the gospel of Jesus to condone slavery was a tricky business, but they could do it, most of it. Jesus may have never explicitly condemned slavery, but surely the main thrust of his teaching certainly could be used to criticize slavery. Golden rule. How do you explain the golden rule? Well, they tried. Well, they said, Jesus didn't intend that we'd be willing to accept other people's fates, but we should treat them as we would want to be treated if their fate was ours. We don't have to be willing to accept, we don't have to be willing to become a slave to commit in the name of Jesus to treating our slaves as we would want to be if for some reason we became a slave. That's kind of slippery, but does it work? Does that work for you? Logically? But the real problem came with the totality of Jesus' ministry, not just the golden rule. As Jordan said a while ago, Jesus' ministry had been overwhelmingly focused on whom? What class of people? The poor, the distressed, the oppressed. Folks, if you don't really know that, then I implore you to read your Bible. All right? That's pretty much all he's ministered to. Young people, who in Antebellum America is poorer, more downtrodden, and more oppressed than the enslaved people of the South? There's really no answer to that.